December 1st, 8:42 p.m., Robert Reich, I think it's pronounced, on Facebook posts, "The Senate bill is moments away from being passed. Never before in the history has Congress worked so quickly, affecting so much of the economy and so many of our people with so little deliberation. There was not a single public hearing, no expert testimony. The 479-page text wasn't even printed in its entirety before the vote. It was released just hours ago. Over the past 24 hours alone, Republicans have cut deals redirecting $500 billion over the next 10 years. If this were a national emergency, in which there was no time for more prolonged consideration, if the economy were teetering on the edge of ruin, if there was broad bipartisan agreement and this were a simple piece of legislation, maybe this lack of due process would be understandable. But none of these conditions hold true. Senate Republicans have done this for only one reason, to pay back their donors, with the public knowing as little as possible about what they're doing. It is the largest transfer of income and wealth from the bottom 99% to the 1% ever attempted. This is a travesty of democracy." And it was only 9 years ago that the last major transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top happened, when the federal government used tax money to bail out the banking system. Wall Street and bankers and politicians on both sides of the aisle invested that money into their lavish lifestyles and then gave themselves executive raises while 4 million Americans were kicked out of their homes and lost their livelihoods. How this tax bill has been pushed through in the middle of the night is an outrage. But even more infuriating is the history of how it's historically come to pass. In this talk, I'm going to give you the total picture of this tax bill and what it represents. First, we'll examine the tax bill itself. Second, we'll examine the history of the bipartisan project since the 1970s that paved the road for this bill while simultaneously impoverishing working poor and producing a social crisis. And lastly, we'll examine the opposition as it stands now and what we can do to kill it. Malcolm X was right when in 1964 he described the conditions of poverty people were living in as the American nightmare. Today the nightmare is even more widespread and pronounced than ever. Most of us are holding our breaths in search of an alternative because so many of the supposed legitimate ways, the social safety net, are gone or are on the chopping block. Those suffering the most dire of circumstances are succumbing to it, as we see rates of mental illness, suicide, and opioid overdoses skyrocket to crisis levels, and the rich do not care. Just to be sure about that, let's see what some of them have to say in the last week. Take, for example, Senator Orrin Hatch, speaking about children's health care. "I have a rough time wanting to spend billions and billions and trillions to help people who won't help themselves, won't lift a finger, and expect the federal government to do everything." Or how about Senator Chuck Grassley? "I think not having the estate tax recognizes that people are investing, as opposed to those who are just spending every darn penny they have, whether it's on booze or women or movies." And these are just some of the defenses of this bill, which give you just a small sense of how the corporate class in the U.S. views the working and poor Americans. Make no mistake, this is the logic of the system expressed as the worldview of our politicians, business executives, their lawyers, lobbyists, bureaucrats, and the best friends on Wall Street. So let's examine the bill. The Week reports on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that, for all the bill's complexity, its underlying math is relatively straightforward. By 2027, people making $40,000 to $50,000 would pay a combined $5.3 billion more in taxes, while the group earning $1 million or more would get a $5.8 billion cut. The New York Times reported, summing up analyses by the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation, it's an almost perfect one-to-one transfer of money from the vast numbers of the Americans in the middle class to the far smaller population that occupies the upper fraction of the top 1%. And the cover story the GOP kept providing was that the tax cuts would trickle down into more jobs and higher wages for everybody. But you could just also listen to the people who actually run businesses in the United States. When a room full of CEOs was asked if they'd plow the money from corporate tax cut back into new investments, almost none of them raised their hands. Bloomberg later reported that CEOs of major companies across the country were planning to pump the tax cut money into bigger shareholder payouts and instead of jobs and or wages. Cuts to the corporate tax rate will be reduced from 35% to 20%, and there is a repeal of the estate tax and alternative minimum tax as well, which New York Mag reports yesterday. In all probability, Republicans are going to drop the alternative minimum corporate tax rate well below 20%. Then in the context of the Panama Papers that exposed the lengths that companies went to offshore their money to avoid taxes, you'll be pleased to hear that if companies bring back the sheltered money from the sheltered money, the government will pay them actually a special 12% rate. And if they fly the money over on their private jets, the bill also gives them a huge tax break on that as well. This really is the art of the deal. No one? So what about the working class and those in the middle income brackets? In 2019, if you make between 10K and 30K, you are just straight up losing money. Then if you make in between 30 and 75K, you start by gaining a few hundred dollars or more, but then by 2021, it all shifts to the losses column. And then by 2027, all people except those who make closer to $100,000 a year will have their taxes raised. During tax season, it's always been a relief to be able to write off certain expenses. What about them? No longer will people be able to write off medical expenses. There will be caps on mortgage interest deductions, property tax deductions, and the elimination of most write-offs on basic necessities. How about education? The elimination of tax waivers and an endowment tax that help American students to afford higher education. Specifically, it rescinds the interest deduction for student loans, elimination of $2,500 tax credits available to parents, and taxes on tuition waivers as income for graduate students, all gone. And of course, places the tax on college endowments, reducing the funds of student scholarships and financial aid at more than 150 colleges across the country. What about healthcare? Well, the ACA mandate will be removed. Premiums will rise by 10%, and 13 million are expected to lose their health care. What about the environment? Corporate tax cuts for fossil fuel industry, the opening up of 1.5 million acres of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas drilling. It will be harder for alternative energy businesses to get tax credits, and spending cuts on the National Flood Insurance Program and on hundreds of millions of funding dollars used for the cleanup of maritime oil spills and coastal and wildlife restoration. Anything else? Union members will not be able to deduct union dues, the codifying of much sought after fetal personhood language, a handout to the anti-abortion forces, which allows for fetuses to be the beneficiaries of tax-free investments, and the reduction of limitations on religious activism and donations in elections. And what of the total cost of the bill? The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget reports that all of these gimmicks add another $275 billion to the cost of the bill for a grand total of $515 billion of gimmicks. Therefore, the cost of the tax bill when removing the gimmicks is actually $1.9 trillion over 10 years. Even if this is not the full cost of the bill, it doesn't account for interest costs. The initial bill will add $280 billion to interest costs, while the gimmicks would add another $25 billion, making the grand total for the bill $2.2 trillion. With expiring provisions extended, debt would reach 99% of the GDP by 2027 and exceed the size of the economy the very next year. This high level of debt is likely to dampen or ultimately reverse pro-growth effects on tax reform. To put that into perspective, all of the calculated and added to the deficit will enable the GOP to say there isn't enough government revenue to go around, so we're going to have to cut spending. And the tax bill isn't even through committee yet, and already mainstream press is listing over 60 smaller programs that they intend to cut. But the bigger story is the massive cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. It's being reported that initial plans to seek to reduce Medicaid by $5.3 trillion over 10 years and $400 billion in Medicare cuts over 10 years, including $25 billion the first year. Food stamps by 30%, 200,000 slots cut from Head Start, K-12 education cut by 30%, eliminating rental assistance by nearly 1 million households, further reducing Pell Grants, and a 40% cut in job training. While the rich have always been honest about their callous disregard toward working and class people, the fact remains it's because they have so much that everyone else has so little. Last month, the IPS report came out with an analysis showing that Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Jeff Bezos now own more wealth than the entire bottom half of the American population combined. We know this is not because the three of them worked harder than everyone else. It's because the American economy has systematically been restructured to benefit the wealthy. And that process is still unfolding. And the tax bill is the largest indicator of that to date. So it would be a mistake to see this as just a project of the GOP. Historically speaking, this started many decades before Trump, and it is a very much a bipartisan effort. So then how, why, and where did this start? In 1974, Business Week saw the writing on the wall that in order for the corporate class to fight back the gains of the previous decades, they'd have to destroy the living standards for workers. They wrote, "It will be a hard pill for many Americans to swallow, the idea of doing less so that big business can have more. Nothing that this nation or any other nation has done in modern economic history compares in the difficulty with the selling job that must now be done to make people accept the new reality." Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party have received most of the credit for implementing tax cuts for the rich and slashing social spending for the poor. But these policies originated years before Reagan took office. The Great Society of 1960s, during which Presidents Kennedy and Johnson increased welfare spending to attract black votes, was short-lived. Tax reform was regressive, and corporate income taxes declined while personal income taxes for the bottom tenth of the population tripled, and for the next lowest tenth, more than doubled. Wages had risen steadily throughout the 60s, and towards the beginning of the 70s, the trend started to reverse and then accelerate. The U.S. ruling class had reached a turning point. Having just been defeated in Vietnam and having been humiliated by a massive anti-war movement at home, the recession of 73 signaled the onset of decline and long-term economic crisis for U.S. capital. Jimmy Carter took office thereafter, and when there were no major social movements to contain, he began the process of joining the Democrats with their Republican counterparts in search of a new social program, not needing anymore to be the party of the New Deal or Great Society. This time, when the corporate class unified around the need to attack workers' living standards and unions in order to reverse the gains made by the working class in the 60s. Carter was the first president to pursue deregulation in the airline industry and combine cuts to social programs with increases on military spending. He also fired the first shots against the right to abortion and affirmative action. This will be the start of the relentless attack on all the victories of the movements of the 60s and 70s. Congress even cut off federal funding for poor women's abortions, leading Carter to say, "There are many things in life that are not fair, that wealthy people can afford and poor people can't. But I don't believe the federal government should take action to try to make these opportunities exactly equal, particularly when there is a moral factor involved." Sounds strikingly familiar, doesn't it? The employers' offensive continued into the 80s. Business tax rates were effectively halved from 33 to 16%, and these reforms were hugely supported by the Democrats in both the House and Congress, or in both houses of Congress. By 83, more than 15% of the population was living below the official poverty level, and by 84, those earning under 10K saw their taxes rise by 22%. And the 1986 Tax Reform Act cut tax rates for the richest individuals from 70 to 28%. The Reagan boom produced the biggest transfer of wealth upwards since the Roaring Twenties, but the ground was laid for him to do so by the previous administration. And according to the official government figures, the number of U.S. taxpayers reporting more than $1 million gross income increased 14-fold between 80 and 89. As a group, their total income grew by 1,630%. To drive the fact home that this was a bipartisan project, you look at 1985, when Bill and Hillary Clinton began the shift of the Democratic Party's core politics to the right from what they called progressive fundamentalism to neoliberalism. They created the Democratic Leadership Council. On the DLC, which is now known as the Clinton Foundation, the Board of Trustees was made up of major donors, including the Koch Industries, Aetna, and Coca-Cola, while its executive board included Enron, AIG, Texaco, Chevron, and AT&T, to name a few. Their mission was to create the new Democrats that were more openly pro-business and much less liberal. By the 1990s, the U.S. was still the richest nation in the world, and by a number of measurements, it was also among the most equal. In Bill Clinton's 96th State of the Union address, he declared, "The era of big government is over." The government, since the 90s, or since that day, has capitalized on those attacks, producing government austerity and economic welfare for the corporate class, and whipped up coded racism to scapegoat and divide people. These policies and politics severely eroded working class living standards. So the 1% has made the world the way that they want on the backs of the working class and poor people and planet be damned. So how do we fight back? Opposition to the tax bill among Americans has grown. A Reuters poll found 49% of people who were aware of it said that they opposed it. A Harvard poll released on Tuesday shows 67% oppose it the way Trump is handling it, and a Quinnipiac University poll from Wednesday shows 78% of millennials believe it benefits the wealthy. And even more telling is the late November poll by Reuters showing the partisan breakdown of support and opposition, finding that among Democrats, 82% oppose it. And even though Forbes downgraded the U.S. from full to flawed democracy, we are still technically in one. So then, what are our representatives doing? We know that the GOP is defending the tax bill, but it seems like the Democrats are not doing much of anything. So one might wonder that when a strong majority of the Democratic Party voter base and half the general population is against the tax bill, why haven't the liberal NGOs, including the unions, called for major demonstrations? Well, they certainly don't support the bill. They think it goes too far. But they do support corporate-friendly changes to the tax code. Hillary Clinton last year vocally supported benefits for the repatriation of profits held overseas, and Senator Chuck Schumer made it clear in a 2016 interview on CNBC that corporate tax cuts were a priority. It's an indication that what they want more than anything else is a return to the days of bipartisan compromise on such issues. Because of their focus on elections, they don't want anything, or they don't want to do anything to rock the boat, and instead hope that they can channel the anger into electoral gains next year. But even if they take back control of Congress next year, we can't expect any significant reversal on tax policy, as history suggests. Consider the last time Republicans used the exact same reconciliation process to push through a massive deficit increase tax cut under President George W. Bush. The second Bush tax cut, the Jobs and Growth Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2003, was approved on a near party line vote, with Vice President Dick Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. Democrats rallied against it at the time and for years after. But when the tax cuts were set to expire, President Obama didn't even let them expire, even though he claimed that the deficit was a massive problem. And in 2010, Obama cut a deal with the Republicans to extend the tax cuts for 2 years. Then two years later, he cut a deal to make them permanent, with only one rate increase for individuals with incomes over $400,000. So what can we do then? I think that with big enough protests, it will be possible to stop the tax bill. It has to go through conference and committee and then get voted on by both houses. It is very late in the day to be building that kind of opposition, but even if the tax bill does go through, protests against it begin to lay the groundwork for building independent politics, which is sorely needed. And another November poll indicated that 71% of millennials want a third party, and for a good reason. We need this third party in order to sustain a bigger resistance. But how do we get from where we are today to where we need to be? Right now, the resistance is smaller, sporadic, and mostly unorganized. But we can see how even sporadic resistance can put up enough pressure to the political system from below that it still can push back some of Trump's most horrific attacks. Think of the Muslim ban that Trump tried to rush through. It sparked off a wave of airport protests, which produced tremendous problems for the ban. It stopped its passing for almost a year. Think of when white supremacists murdered an anti-racist activist in Charlottesville, Virginia, which precipitated a series of embarrassing defeats for the far right and resulted in almost every major news outlet running stories about Trump enabling white supremacists. Think of Trump's attempt to repeal and replace the ACA, another groundswell of opposition across the country, which made an impact. Though the Republicans had a majority then, enough were shaken up and believed that they would pay a political price by backing the legislation, they abandoned it. And given how close the vote was, the Democrats were actually not in the worst position to upset the vote. Instead, they surrendered. There wasn't even a parliamentary tactic at opposition, like a filibuster or a challenging of the undemocratic nature of the ramming through of the vote via the rules. There wasn't even a symbolic opposition. Last year, House Democrats did a sit-in about gun control. Given the scale of this of attack that this tax bill represents, even theatrical opposition would have been something. Throughout the week, thousands have taken to the streets, campuses, government offices, politicians' offices and homes, and cities across the U.S., building momentum from the week before when the graduate students protested. If sustained, this opposition can produce another inflection point in the narrative and rip apart the unity of congressional Republicans. To be sure of this, Jeff Spross writes in The Week, "The tax bill reveals a Republican Party that is profoundly weak, despite controlling every branch of government. This legislation is a heist, pure and simple, a massive raid on the American people, done with speed and in the dead of night. That's not the act of a party confident in its hold on power. It's the act of a party desperate for one last big score. It will be difficult because most Democrats appear unwilling to help, and there is a sense of exhaustion relative to earlier in 2017 when there were large enthusiastic demonstrations. Many liberal forces have focused on rebuilding our side's power in accordance with conceptions that don't rely at all on mass action as a way to directly intervene in political and economic life, or even that rely on the politics of solidarity to unify disparate forces fighting on single issues. And though the Democrats' liberal base is furiously against the tax cuts, the party leadership and apparatus is more muted. After all, to get elected to the Senate, top Democrats need support from the same wealthy individual and corporate contributors that the Republican tax bill was written about. For many Democratic senators, it doesn't pay, literally, to be loudly opposed, particularly on the core provisions of the tax cut, giveaways to business. And then there's the cynical calculation that the Democrats will be in a better position for 2018 midterm elections if Trump and the Republicans force through unpopular legislation. Thus, the twisted logic of one comment at the politicalwire.com website saying, "If I were the campaign manager of the Democratic candidate running for Congress in 2018, I would be praying this bill passes." Yet despite these difficulties, we must operate under the conception that the tax bill can be stalled and ultimately stopped and support, and that this will come to pass only through united mass action. Monday's editorial for Socialist Worker puts it clearly. We have an opportunity in the next few weeks to throw our efforts into the fight against the Republican tax cut in support of graduate students and anyone else who want to challenge this atrocity. We might not win if we fight, but we definitely won't win if we never fight at all. And whatever the outcome, the example we set now can help build a stronger resistance for the future.